welcome everybody to History, Mystery, and Beyond. I am your host, Frankie Adeo, and this is a show for the curious mind. So if you like true crime, if you like horror, if you like paranormal, if you like conspiracy theories, if you like the unknown, this is the show for you. So last time we talked about America's first serial killer, H.H. Holmes. Well, today I want to drop you right on Halloween, something nice and juicy and scary, and we're going to be talking about the exorcism of Roland Doe. If you've never heard of the exorcism of Roland Doe, you actually have, because the exorcism of Roland Doe, real life events, was what William Peter Blatty based his best-selling novel, The Exorcist, which led to the screenplay, which led to the most craziest, insane, scary movie of all time, which it still holds up today as one of the, if not the scariest movie probably that I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of shit. So the movie was actually released the day after Christmas on December 26th of 1973, and when moviegoers went into the movies, they lost their shit. So people were going into the movie theaters because they heard a lot of buzz about this movie.
Devil coming out of her. My legs are just going, and I want to go to the lobby and not watch it, and I have to cover my ears. I can't even describe it. It's horrible. It just scared me to death. Things just like this just really scared me to death. I'm just nervous.
Are you going to go back in and see more of the movie now?
Probably, yeah.
People were getting like nauseous and vomiting during the movies. Some people actually had like trauma after the movie.
I passed out in about the first half hour. Yeah.
I don't know what this should do with that movie, but I don't want to see the rest of it.
I fainted like 10 minutes after the first beginning of the movie.
Moviegoers flooded the Catholic Church for service and attendance to different services. And the Catholic Church also got a like spike in people wanting to have exorcisms performed on people they know or, you know, for themselves. So the way that William Peter Blatty actually got even like wind of this whole thing was he went to Georgetown University and was in good with one of the priests there. He was a English major, and the priest shared, you know, when William was telling them that he wanted to write a book about exorcisms and things like that in the Catholic Church, they told him that they had this diary or this journal from a group of Catholic priests who actually performed a real-life exorcism that was pretty intense, and they documented it, and that's what they gave William, and that's what he was inspired to after reading the diary. I mean, I'm going to post it in the link below, but after you read it, if you imagine reading it for the first time and or hearing the stories from priests about it and being moved to write this, I mean, the meat and potatoes were there for William Peter Blatty to have a bestseller book, because it was a real life event. So the book actually chronicles a boy's journey through the exorcism, where the movie kind of takes on a different shape, and it's about Reagan. So we kind of know that it's not a boy or whatever, but a lot of it had to be masked, sort of say, because a lot of his privacy to this day is still very held. Let's start off with this. It's a timeline that we're going to go down, guys, so it's going to be a little different than H.H. Holmes. We're going to go through the timeline right from the journal. I read the motherfucking journal from the priest. So we're going to hit every day that they were experiencing things from the exorcism. We'll even get a little bit of insight into what Roland was going through, his family was going through, and even talk some conspiracy theories. So Roland's story starts in Cottage City, Maryland, early 1949. So we're talking about before, you know, things like religion and stuff were easy to talk about. I mean, they're still not easy to talk about today, but we talk a little bit more freely about religion now than we did back then. So a lot of this stuff was like unmarked territory for Roland's family. He is known as Roland. That is not his real name, but that's kind of what the church adapted as an alias for him to keep his privacy protected. Bolin was a 13-year-old boy growing up in Cottage City, Maryland, and it is said that he wasn't really a bad kid, but he often had like problems concentrating in school, which led to him kind of coming off as like troublesome behavior. But he was a good student. He wasn't a bad kid. There were no like real signs like we know of that sometimes could lead to like psychological stuff that's really fucked up. But with Roland, he was just an average kid just growing up in 1949. Roland was actually really super close to his Aunt Tilly, and back then it was the boom of the spiritualism movement. So that is basically people were talking about and really exploring and pursuing the afterlife and communing with the afterlife. Aunt Tilly was super, super into it. She would even sit when she came over and show Roland how to communicate with the dead. They would use a spirit board, which we know as a Ouija board. But some have said that that's actually what started the whole thing to happen with Roland, is that it was an invitation for some darker stuff that maybe they weren't skilled into having done, so you can open those doors and those portals for other things from the other side to come through. And then, you know, it was something that they bonded over. Roland's parents kind of like were not aware of what Aunt Tilly was really teaching him, but they just knew that they were like super close. Then on January 15th, Aunt Tilly passes away, and Roland takes it. He's devastated by her passing. Quickly after Aunt Tilly passes away, Roland's parents and family start hearing things like scratches on the walls, and they're like, you know, like, what the fuck is this? So they're not thinking anything paranormal. They're thinking that they have like rodents or something in the wall. So they have an exterminator come in, and the exterminator does a full-on search and doesn't find anything that should be causing the scratch. And since there's nothing to explain these scratches that Roland's mother is hearing, she's automatically convinced that the house is haunted. So thinking that the house is haunted, they're automatically thinking that, okay, it has to be Tilly. It has to be her. She's trying to communicate with us some way. So it becomes so intense that Roland's mother's like, if it's you, Tilly, knock 3 times. And it was said that she asked and she heard 3 knocks. And so they were convinced that any of these paranormal things that kind of were happening were a sign that Tilly was trying to communicate maybe with Roland through Roland, because they have had that bond together and a way for her to communicate through him. Then on January 26th, 1949, things really started to like go beyond the point where they thought it was Aunt Tilly who was communicating with them. They would be hearing scratches. They would hear footsteps, like multiple footsteps that sounded like almost like an army troop that would be marching. They could hear it from, you know, from above, going from one end to Ronald's room up to his bed. Then they would hear things like strange noises coming from Roland's room. Things would go flying against the wall or falling or breaking unexplainably. And it was at this point that the parents actually thought that it was like a poltergeist in the house. So a poltergeist is not like a possession. It's a presence of a spirit or something manifesting in the house or an object rather than a person. And so that's what they thought was going on. So in February 1949, Roland's situation started becoming physical. So instead of all this noise and unexplained things happening, Roland started experiencing like fits of rage, and he would curse and he would get violently aggressive with people, his family. So his family were, you know, super concerned. So they took him to a neurologist. Nothing was wrong with his brain. They took him to several psychologists and psychiatrists who did multiple tests on Roland and all came up negative. Like, there was nothing psychologically going on with him. So there was nothing that could explain what was this whole transition and manifestation of a different Roland that the parents were like not prepared for or had no idea where a lot of the stuff was coming from. The only medical record, which is super interesting, that exists in the story of Roland Doe is one medical record from a psychiatrist that actually assessed Roland, and the psychiatrist on paper wrote out a report saying that Roland absolutely had no psychological issues, no mental health issues going on, that whatever it was, he felt that it was maybe something neurological that was going on that's not being caught by tests, and pretty much gave him a clean bill of health and sent him on his way. And that led to Roland's parents being so frustrated because the stuff was still happening, but there was no way to explain where this was all coming from. It just progressively started getting really, really worse and bad and uncontrollable, and the parents were like at their wit's end. So the parents actually reached out to Reverend Schultz in their church. They were not Catholic, I believe they were Lutheran, and they, you know, basically were telling him what was going on with Roland. And Reverend Schultz actually had an interest in parapsychology, which is kind of interesting, because it mirrors kind of like what Father Carassus in Exorcist was kind of, he was a psychologist, so, and he was a priest, so kind of like on the same thing, because parapsychology is not really, even to this day, looked at like and like a credible evidence-based kind of practice within the world of psychology. So even back then, for him to be exploring it or interested in it or kind of like a specialist in the in that time was super like rare. What happened was Reverend Schultz went in and kind of did like an assessment of what was going on, because he wanted to see if it was like truth. He wanted to see if it was not just like behavioral issues going on with Roland that the parents weren't admitting what were going on. Reverend Schultz actually went to the house for like one night, overnight, and saw that Roland, these fits that would come on normally, like at nighttime when it was time to go to like bed and they would like shut the lights off and stuff, he would go into these fits, and it was said that he would speak in these like guttural multiple voices, and things would fly across the room, furniture would move. So seeing this, Reverend Schultz is like, okay, something's going on, maybe it is a poltergeist, so let me remove Roland out of the home, evaluate him, and see if, you know, the events still happen. So back then, we're talking 1949, so I mean, probably wouldn't have somebody sleep over a priest's house right now, but especially a child, so no hate mail from any priest. Reverend Schultz has Roland come to his house, brought Roland over to his house. He had his wife sleep in a guest bedroom, and back then in 1949, there were like the double bed situation going on. So Roland slept in one bed, Reverend Schultz slept in the other, because Reverend Schultz wanted to like really like observe him for 24 hours. And it didn't even last half of the night when Roland, his bed started to like shake, and you know, that woke up Reverend Schultz, and he's like, well, you know, what's going on? You know, he doesn't really know that for sure if it's something paranormal or if it's Roland like kind of like playing tricks and seeking attention. So he tells Roland to get out of the bed and go sit in an armchair, where he kind of like tied Roland up. Yeah, I know, tied him up, went back to bed. Within moments, the armchair that he was strapped to starts shaking and vibrating and convulsing, and it actually flips the chair over. So Reverend Schultz picks him up, unties him, and gives him the mattress from the bed and lets him sleep on the floor. And again, within moments, Roland's mattress started like sliding and shifting over, you know, span of the room, and then said to swiftly have went underneath the bed where he was like literally convulsing underneath the bed. And this really freaked out Reverend Schultz. So then Reverend Schultz is basically like, okay, so it's not the house. Let's bring him back to the house. So after this, Reverend Schultz is like, you know, this is definitely something else is going on. It's not a poltergeist because it's happening in my house. And usually poltergeists don't travel with a person. They stay within the area or in the object. So he's like, you know, something else is going on. So he's like, let's move Roland. Poor Roland, through the course of this journey, gets sort of moved around so much. I feel so bad for the kid on top of everything else that's going on. But they move him back into his home, and where, you know, Reverend Schultz is still observing him. And it's starting to progressively even get worse. So the fits are getting worse. The rage is getting worse. Now, all of a sudden, scratch marks, unexplainable scratch marks, start appearing on Roland's body, like really deep, causing like blood and scarring. And Reverend Schultz is like, it's definitely not him doing like self-harm because of the fact that I'm watching him this whole time. So there's no way this kid could be making these scratches on his body. So what Reverend Schultz is like, you know, this is above like my pay scale. So what he does is he starts kind of like talking to people who he worked with in the church who maybe have connections, and it's recommended that maybe Reverend Schultz reach out to a Catholic priest because of the fact that the Catholic Church, it's like their experience in possession and exorcisms. So if that's what's going on, we need to go to the people that really are quote unquote said to be the experts in this kind of stuff. So Roland's family and Reverend Schultz are recommended to speak with Father Albert Hughes, who is a Catholic priest at the local St. James Church. And they're basically telling him what's going on. So Father Hughes basically says, bring him down to my office. Let me kind of observe what's going on. And it is said that from everybody in the room that when Roland came into the room, the temperature like dropped like drastically, and things like the phone and stuff started like sliding and moving around the room. But Father Hughes still didn't like have enough to say like, this is possession, this boy needs an exorcism, because like that's not something like the Catholic Church, you can just walk into your Catholic Church and say, I need an exorcism, and they perform the exorcism, you're on your merry way. It actually has to get approved through like the higher channels in the Catholic Church, like the Archbishop, which is basically what happened is Father Hughes saw what was going on and felt that it needed to be like brought higher up. So they contacted the local Archbishop, Patrick O'Boyle, and was telling him what was going on over the course of the last couple of weeks with Roland and what his family was reporting, what Reverend Schultz was reporting, what he saw. So Archbishop O'Boyle reluctantly kind of said, okay, we're going to pursue this whole notion of it's a possession, possible exorcism. So it is said between February 27th and March 6th of 1949, Father Hughes again moved Roland out of the home and brought him over to Georgetown Hospital, where they had him like restrained. They were watching him, you know, close eye, 24/7 observation. Roland was like almost like a like an animal. He would bite, he would claw at people, he would curse, he would spit, he would say like vile, nasty things to the staff and to Father Hughes and the priest that he brought in with him to kind of like go through what this process was going to be like. So when Father Hughes and the priest in the room started kind of like saying prayers over Roland to start the possible exorcism, it said that Roland kind of like broke free from one of like the arm restraints and reached down at the bottom of the bed and pulled out like one of the springs from the fucking bed and stabbed Father Hughes from shoulder to wrist, cut him open. Yeah. He's a stabber. that actually caused Father Hughes to get like 100 stitches, and was said that he can never really use his arm again after that. And so like after that, it was totally like, no, there's really nothing that we can do to help him. So we're going to send him back home. So they sent him back home again, and Roland said that he can't even look at himself in the mirror without like going into these fits of rage, and that the nightly terrors are still happening. They're still hearing sounds. They're still hearing like these guttural voices coming from him and his room. And I can't even imagine as a parent, like, not seeing your child go through this, not knowing what it is, hearing that it's nothing psychological, nothing physical. Now we have priests involved. We're taking it to all these different types of religious professionals, and no one's able to give us any type of resolution, but it's getting progressively fucking worse. So one night when they're over Roland and they're saying like prayers, Roland starts like screaming that that, you know, he's being like scratched and feeling it burning. And they basically see like the word Louis, L-O-U-I-S, appear on his chest. And they were saying that it wasn't like carved. It would look like it was branded and burned into his skin from the inside out. And again, they're watching Roland this whole time. So it's not like they, you know, you're going to need some time if you're going to do something like that. So it wasn't something easily that he could just pull off that nobody was going to take notice of. And so this was like what really convinced Father Hughes that something was going on, and the connection was made that Roland's family, his uncle, his father's brother, lived in St. Louis. So they thought that it was maybe possibly a sign that somebody, maybe Aunt Tilly, was trying to communicate that Roland had to be taken to St. Louis. So they basically, within like a day, packed up their stuff, and they didn't move to St. Louis, but they went to a family member's house, Roland's uncle, Roland's father's brother's house, and they were strict, like, devout Catholics, so they figured, okay, maybe this is a sign. So they packed up their stuff and went to 8435 Roanoke Drive in St. Louis, Missouri, where the uncle lived, and were hoping to get some answers, some relief, some support from the family, so it wasn't all on their own. I mean, it was said that Roland's uncle and aunt really loved Roland. They really loved their family, so they really were gonna do everything that they possibly can to make sure that Roland got the help that he needed. So now it's March 8th, right? A couple days later after they first get to St. Louis, and Roland's fits are even more severe than they were when he was in Georgetown, or when he was at home. Things start flying all over the place again. These fits of like rage are just progressing to almost like superhuman strength. So it's March 8th, 1949, and it's a couple days after they get to St. Louis, and things are just not easing up, guys. So they really don't know what to do anymore. They're not really getting any answers. So Roland's cousin, who lives in the house, goes to St. Louis University, and she knows a Jesuit priest by the name of Father Raymond Bishop, who she's kind of telling him like what's going on, like, hey dude, like, this, my cousin's in the house, he is like some other type of creature, or I don't know what's going on, we think he's possessed. We're getting all these people coming in and no one's giving us any answers. So Father Bishop agrees to go to kind of like observe Roland in the home. So on March 11th, 1949, Father Bishop actually brings some backup with him to the house. So he goes with Father William Bowdern, Bowdern is like going to be a significant person in Roland's journey throughout the kind of telling of this timeline, you'll hear from him a lot or hear about him a lot. And according to Bowdern's niece, who was, there's a super cool shock doc documentary that's on Discovery Plus, and it's The Exorcism of Roland Doe. And so Bowdern's niece is interviewed in this documentary, and she basically says, like, everybody, if you were gonna kind of like say what her uncle was known for, like, he was a really stand up, honest guy. Like, he, you know, had no reason to make things up or to lie. So the accounts that we have from Bowdern are pretty credible and should be taken as such, because that was like kind of like his legacy outside of this whole Exorcism of Roland Doe situation. He really was a stand-up guy. So, I mean, the family, people who worked with him all, you know, took him for his word. So we should hold the, you know, what he gave us as far as an account of what was happening as, you know, factual things that really took place. So on March 11th, 1949, about 11 o'clock, the two priests start like kind of like praying over Roland. They really don't see much of activity going on. Nothing is odd. He's kind of pretty calm and peaceful, getting, you know, going to bed and falling asleep. So the priests actually leave. So when the priests leave, all hell starts breaking loose. So like furniture starts flying around. Roland's back to like his fits and cursing and spitting and being violent with the family. So they immediately call the priest back, and the priests come back. The priests see firsthand like what's going on. Like, oh shit. So Father Bowdern is not like a exorcist trained priest, right? So he's just like a normal priest, and you know, you really have to be in that part of the Catholic Church to be able to like even have privy to like what it's like to do an exorcism, because it's very secretive, which is weird, because if we all know that they're going on, why are you being secretive about it, you know, even to this day? So Father Bowdern reaches out for like what should he be kind of like doing to start the process of this exorcism. So there is a book that the Catholic Church has, and it's called The Ritual Romanum, and it's basically like the instructions for doing an exorcism. Father Bowdern is like, okay, so I'm just gonna like get this thing and I'm gonna like start the process of it. I really don't know what I'm doing. It was said that Father Bowdern was definitely like solid in his spiritual faith, but was not confident that it was enough to go down the path of actually doing an exorcism. So like there's faith, and then like there's like faith because you're probably going to be tested, you're gonna see some shit, and you know, even the most devout spiritual person probably wouldn't be able to pursue with the exorcism, because it would just literally kill them. So even in the Bible it talks about exorcism, not the spiritual Romanum, but the actual Bible, the Catholic Bible or the Christian Bible, talks about Jesus, who used to perform exorcisms on his disciples. There's probably about, like right now, about over 100 priests or so that literally are through the Catholic Church to perform exorcisms to this day. So there's not like a ton of priests out there that do that, but there are priests out there, and there's probably like an exorcism going on right now as we speak, and that is some crazy ass shit. So when we're talking about like exorcism, we have to keep it in perspective, because the church hears stories about stuff, people have like really bad psychological schizophrenia, things like that, so they're used to hearing like possible almost like parapsychology stuff. They're hearing, people are hearing voices, they're seeing things. So is it a spiritual thing, or is it like mental health issues that are going on? You just can't go in and say that somebody is possessed and needs an exorcism. There are like four stages that the Catholic Church calls clear path to possession. So the first part is demonic infestation. So that's the presence of evil in like a space. So almost like a poltergeist, but from evil. So poltergeists don't have to be an evil entity. It could be somebody that is just residually in the building or in the object, or, you know, if it's something evil, then it's more of a demonic infestation. So again, the presence of evil in a space or an object. Then there's demonic vexation. So demonic vexation is when somebody believes that they're literally physically being attacked, or they're being violated by a demonic entity. Then there's demonic obsession, which is when a person who's being possessed, that they're mentally being possessed, that there's someone that mentally is controlling them. Then there's the final stage, which is demonic possession. So that's full-on possession. The entity has taken hold of you as a vessel and as a conduit. And it's also said that Roland had like the first three. Browning got there and was like, okay, so now he's like teetering on like going from like the last stage, which is the demonic obsession, with going into the demonic possession. They didn't think he was fully possessed at that point. They just felt that it was nearing, and they really had to take drastic measures. So Father Bowden has to now, like, he's reading through this stuff, and he's like, and performing some of this stuff, like, kind of on his own. So he goes to the Archbishop Joseph Ritter to request the exorcism. He doesn't have experience. So he's saying to Archbishop Ritter, like, listen, man, I think this kid needs an exorcism, but yo, bro, I am not the one to do it. I'm not qualified, above my pay scale. Have somebody else do that. I will be there. I will be a participant and help and volunteer, but I do not want to be the one to lead the charge of doing this possession and doing harm to the, possibly to this kid. I want to make sure that this kid gets the best that he can. Archbishop Ritter basically turns around and says to him, like, listen, yo, Bowden, you want to do this exorcism? Then you're going to have to do it. Nobody's going to do it, you know. And Father Bowden is like, I just don't have any experience with this. Archbishop Ritter basically is like, I'm leaving it up to you. If you want it to happen, it happens, but it happens on your watch and you take the lead. So on March 16th, 1949, it's basically day one of the actual exorcism. What I would tell you guys is Hollywood gets it all fucked up. When we watch possession movies and we watch like movies like Exorcism of Emily Rose, The Exorcist, we are seeing it in Hollywood's time. So like within like 24 hours, you know, I think The Exorcist actually happened over like a week or two tops. But that's just not how an exorcism works. Real life exorcisms can take days, they can take weeks, they can take months, and there are even some exorcisms that are taking place now that have been taking place with that same person for years. In the Catholic Church, the reports are like crazy. There are some people who are like go through exorcism and it's a couple days. It's not going to be just like a one day and done in Roland's exercise and then he can go back to normal life. No, this is the story that the chronology of it is over months. So day one doesn't start off easy. So Bowden is like, okay, so I'm going to do this. I'm going to take it on. I want to have like a team of Jesuit priests with me that can help me kind of perform the tasks. We can share like the responsibilities because it is daunting. And I also want to have somebody document and record what's going on. So we almost then have like a manual to performing an exorcism out, kind of something a little bit more current than the ritual Roman, a modern day take on it. We're gonna document this thing. So he brings a Jesuit priest student by the name of Father Halloran, and his role is not only to like help, but to just basically be the main record keeper of what's going on. They start like unpacking like all their stuff that they bring. Like, you know, they have crucifix, holy water, holy relics that they're gonna use to perform the ritual of the exorcism. Father Bowden is kind of like looking at this kid, and this kid is like all scarred up. He's got like all these markings on him, words and like stuff that's on his body that obviously he did not create or anybody create. The pain and anguish that this kid was in, he was said that he would like anytime the priest would say prayers or like use holy water, he would go into like these really like freaky contorted seizures. And they could last anywhere between like 1 minute to like up to 10 minutes. They were like super trepidatious to kind of like really do some of the stuff that the ritual entails, because the ritual entails like having them wear like holy relics and holding the crucifix and being doused with holy water. So every time that they would do this, they would get like, he would like violently fight back and have these reactions towards it. This ensued for like 9 hours the first day. Roland was like exhausted, collapses in sleep. But the priest, Bowdern, actually is like, oh shit, I don't know if this is really helping or it's kind of making matters worse. Like, they want to save him for full possession, but they're feeling like Bowdern's not feeling too confident about how the first like 9 hours is going, which is a telltale sign of how things are gonna go. He's like, I don't know, maybe we should kind of like ease up on what we're doing, take it at a slower pace. In the next couple of days, the exorcism just progressively, where the possession actually gets a lot worse. And they're still like using their tools, their relics, they're dousing with holy waters, prayers upon prayers upon prayers. And then all of a sudden, Roland sits up and he's like, open the window, open the window, open the window. I have to throw up, I have to throw up. So the priests are like, oh my God, like maybe the spirits or whatever's inside of him, this is really working. So they open up the windows and basically Roland says that the spirit is out of him. So now Roland's like, okay, I think I'm good, guys, you know? So the priests are like, oh, you know, we're gonna give you your space to do your thing. But that only lasts for a couple of days, when it's like 3:15 in the morning and the family is like awoken by Roman, and he's basically saying that like, he's back. So they immediately call Father Bowder and they're like, listen, we've been duped, because it's still, whatever's inside of Roland is now back. So, you know, we need you to come here. We're starting to see like the same pattern of like fits and rage and being violently aggressive. So Father Bowden comes back with the crew, and he starts the ritual of exorcism again. What was said in the next like weeks, what shook Bowden to like his absolute core, changed him forever. And we're only talking like the first 4 days, guys. This poor kid, and this is 4 days into the exorcism. I mean, he started back in January going through all this. So you're talking about like 3 months in, and the exorcism is just now starting to happen. And in the first couple of days, it's already gone fucking left. So it's March 20th, 1949, and it's day five into the exorcism of Roland Doe. And the priests are having a really tough time with him. Things are not getting any easier for them, and no relief for Roland. It's only getting progressively worse. So Father Halloran, later on, before he passed, he kind of gave a, you know, before he passed on, he spoke with people about the incident, and he basically was saying that there was one night that he literally was at like the foot of Roland's bed, and the bed levitating about 8 inches off the floor and then slamming down on the floor. Eyewitnesses were there too, and they said that they saw it as well. It's at this time like the family is now just like, okay, this whole religious thing of exorcism is not like, they don't want to put all their eggs in one basket kind of thing. So they reach out to mathematician and professor Frank Bubb, who, if you don't know who Frank Bubb is, Frank Bubb was one of the minds behind the Manhattan Project, which was the first atomic bomb. that's a whole nother story that we can get down on another episode. But it's super interesting that he jumped at the opportunity. So think about it. You have a professor who is creating an atom bomb. The idea where they were going, why they had Frank Bubb come in, is not really said, but I'm assuming they were trying to look at it on a more scientific level, because there was one night that Frank Bubb was there and one of the end tables levitated and then slammed back down while he was there and he witnessed it. He really didn't think it was so much possession that it was what we more needed to learn about electromagnetism, which was kind of like a hot theory at that time about in science. So that's where he was coming from, but he really kind of didn't take it as, because he didn't see a lot of the events that the family was describing. It was just that one event where the table levitated. So, you know, he was thinking that maybe something else was going on, not paranormal. Then on March 26, 1949, day 11 into the exorcism of Roland Doe. We're not even halfway there, guys, and I so feel bad for this kid, because think about a 13-year-old going through all of this. Maybe some people thinking, like, skeptical, like, what is this kid, you know, is this, like, what kind of behavior are we being witness to? And then you have some people who are like, yeah, this is really going on, and we just don't know how to fix it, and we're hoping and praying that these priests that we have coming in doing this exorcism, that seems like such a traumatizing, physically and mentally, spiritually exhausting process for the priest and for Roland. So the problem now becomes that there's like a lot of attention that's being drawn. So, you know, like, people are hearing things at night. Father Bowden is like, okay, we need to move this kid out of here. And I guess I could see why they moved him a lot, because they were trying to avoid like a lot of attention coming to the matter. Like, if the media took hold of this or public found out, there would be like hysteria. So Father Bowden has Roland move to the rectory of St. Francis Xavier College Church in St. Louis, you know, where he's there for a very, very brief time, because it's on a college campus. So students, faculty, staff, they're like on campus at night, and they hear all these like crazy sounds and banging and crashing and yelling and screaming coming from the rectory, which is usually not what you hear coming from a rectory. So it was very short stay for him there. During this time, like, Roland now is taking over like the strength of like three men. Not normal for a 13-year-old boy. He wasn't like a big 13-year-old boy. He was like a kind of skinny, scrawny 13-year-old boy. So for him to be, for three guys to have to hold him, 13-year-old down, 13-year-old either needs to be like jacked, or the 13-year-old, there's something going on. Trying to like physically restrain and keep this kid safe, in addition to trying to keep with like the rituals of the exorcism. And because he has like the strength of like all these guys, he actually breaks free from one of the restraints and fucking punches Howland right in the nose and breaks his nose. So you want to talk about dedication to trying to help this kid. These priests went through it. It wasn't just Roland going through it. It actually was the priests too who were getting like the shit kicked out of them by this 13-year-old boy with superhuman strength. And because they're on the college campus and they're attracting way too much attention, too many people are asking questions, too many people are wondering like what's going on at the rectory, what, you know, it sounds like a horror movie's going on there. And Bowden's like, okay, we have to get them back out. So they basically move back to the family's home in Belnar, where they're basically like, okay, let's see what we can accomplish here at the house, because it's just like wherever we move this kid, we're causing a scene. So and that's going to do more damage to him than helping him out. Within 5 days, they basically see that things are starting to settle down. They're like, okay, like maybe, again, hopeful that things are going to be passing and Roland will kind of return back to his normal 13-year-old self. It was at that time that Roland's fits and behavior started to like kick up again, like day 6 after that 5-day reprieve. And he was said that he, when he was going into these fits now, that he wanted to like write, like he wanted to like scribe things that were, I guess, like in his head, or what was being told, or who knows who is manifesting into wanting to scribe. Was it Roland? Was it the demons that were possessing him? They would give him like these big sheets of paper so he could just like write and draw, and like they would kind of decipher what was going on. So one night while they're observing him writing, he starts writing, and the priests are reading it and they're like, oh shit. And it says that he basically writes, I will stay 10 days, but will return after 5 are up. I am the devil himself. You want to talk about overachieving? Not only are you going to be possessed, you're not going to be possessed by like how Reagan in The Exorcist was possessed. She was possessed by a demon. She wasn't possessed by the devil himself. Pazuzu is actually the one that was said to possess her under the name of Captain Howdy. Roland is saying like, I am possessed by the, you're talking to the devil himself. It actually had Roman numerals on it, so that's kind of like, this wasn't even Roland kind of like creating this stuff and embellishing. And it really kind of like said to the priest, like, oh my God, it's like 5 days, and 5 days are up, and guess what? We're starting to see things again, even back into the house. So on April 1st, 1949, we're talking day 17, into the exorcism of Roland Doe, and Bowden suggests that Roland be baptized in the Catholic Church, because remember, he's originally Lutheran. They're at the Catholic family's, we're at the Catholic family's home, but he's still not baptized under the Catholic Church. So Bowden is like, okay, so let's have him baptized in the Catholic Church, because baptism is actually a form of exorcism. So when you're a child, or whenever you enter into the Catholic Church, you're supposed to be baptized. You're actually a form of exorcism, and the fact that you're denouncing like any bad stuff, and accepting God into your life. So they're like, okay, let's just get this kid baptized and see what happens. So on the way to the church, now it's Roland in the back seat, with his aunt and his uncle, and the father and the mother in the front seat, and they're driving to the church, and Roland starts like flipping out. He starts saying like, you're not gonna give me communion, I am not gonna go into, you know, this Catholic church, I'm not gonna, he starts like freaking out. He starts trying to claw his way to the front seat of the driver's side of the car, so much so it gets so crazy that they have to pull over because they're afraid that like something is, you know, an accident, something's gonna happen. So, you know, they were like, wow, like this is some crazy shit. This kid does not want to go to this church. It's not just like, I don't want to go to church. It's like there's a visceral reaction. Why, like life or death, why? I do not want to get into this church. So they basically drag him into the church, like kicking, screaming, cursing, or whatever. And they're performing the baptism, and he's convulsing. He's like talking in like these guttural voices. And they're like, just, we can't do this full on hour baptism. So we're going to do like the Mickey D version and do like a fast, a real quick baptism on him, and send him on his way. And so they baptize him, and then they bring him back to the house. And it seems like things start to settle for like a couple of days, but wait, there's more. On April 4th, 1949, Father Bowden decides maybe it's best that the family return to their actual home, like their home in Maryland. Father Bowden's like, look, we're gonna move you back. I'm gonna try to find like a monastery, something in the Maryland area or the DC area where we can kind of like put this kid. No one is willing to help. There's no churches or psychiatric facilities that are willing to like take this on, because it's just, one, so controversial, two, like they're looking at it like whatever, you know, they're not taking it too seriously. What happens is, Father Bowden's like, okay guys, my bad, fail, we can't find him any place here, let's move him back to St. Louis. But instead of moving him back into your family's home, we're going to move him into the Alexian Brother Hospital, which the Alexian Brothers are like this secret order of Catholic monks that, you know, are things are kept very secret about how they move and they exist in the world, you know, some Illuminati shit. Then that way, if we can get him into this Alexian Brother Hospital, we won't have to be worried about like moving him around all the time. They're the best at keeping things kind of under wraps. They're also known for taking on like really bad schizophrenic, severely mental health diagnosis kind of stuff that are really heavy, that people kind of like maybe they would don't want the public to see, you know, because mental health back then, even in like the late 40s, early 50s, it's still not something that was comfortable to be talked about. They weren't looking at mental health like we do today. Everything was under the purview of it being so much worse than what we know of things today and how to manage it today. So they get rolling into this Alexian Brother Hospital, right? On April 10th, 1949, it's day 26. Day 26 of just the exorcism, not the full process of when he started in January. Day 26 of from when the actual exorcism started. It actually was the beginning of Holy Week with the Catholic Church, which within the Catholic Church, Holy Week is their shit. They really like have all these ceremonies and processions leading up to Easter holiday. And so all this stuff is coming up. So like in the best place that they can kind of be and during time, because like Holy Week prayers are like going up like crazy. Like, okay, like this is working out perfect. According to one of the Alexian brothers, Father Greg Holowinski, he gave a interview before he died in 2014, an account about what happened during Roland's time at the Alexian Brother Hospital.
There was a boy laying in bed. There were three priests that were the exorcists. During the prayers of the possession, the priest wears a stole. It's a fine silk ribbon. The devil, using the boy's hand, reached over and snatched that silk cloth. And within a split second, it was a thousand threads. You could feel the powers of the devil. I saw the boy's body levitate. My ears at the foot of the bed, and had my arms crossed over from his ankle to his knee. I was there. What I saw was real. What I touched was real. It was an experience that I would never forget.
A lot of the accounts that we're talking about right now actually happen. It wasn't just like one or two priests that were always in the room. There were like groups of priests now that are kind of involved in the room, eyewitness to all this stuff. And Father Holowinski was one of them and came forth, luckily, before he died to, you know, just also validate Bowdern's accounts of what was going on. You know, there's just more people are popping up saying like, yeah, this thing really did happen. It's not like just some Hollywood makeup type of stuff. On April 13th of 1949, day 29, almost a month into the exorcism, Halloran basically takes Roland to like this retreat. So they're like, maybe let's get him out of just all of this, give him a break. So there is a the White House retreat, outdoor retreat. It was like on a bluff, like, so there, it was out in nature. They're thinking like, okay, let's just get this kid, you know, something different. And it seems to be okay, but on the grounds, there's like a path that you can take that has different statues of the Stations of the Cross, which Stations of the Cross, if you're not familiar with it in the Catholic religion, it kind of depicts the day Jesus was taken from his home to be crucified. So there's like different stations of his day before he died. and leading up to his resurrection. So as they're walking down, you know, Roland's kind of like very inquisitive, and he's like really into hearing about the different stations. They get to the 14th station. 14th station was not good for Roland. Things took a major turn. Roland started freaking out when he saw the depiction of Jesus being taken to his tomb. He kind of like freaks out. He starts like going into like this panic. All of a sudden he starts like running towards like the edge of the bluff, because this place is like on like this cliff. Okay, in hindsight, probably not the best place to take him. They were hoping on religious grounds, something that would help, and it didn't. Halloran's plan again backfires. Roland, like I said, was running towards the edge of the cliff to the point where Halloran had to run after him and like tackle him before he ran over. And Roland was like in like a fit when he was trying to restrain him, and Roland just kind of like stops for like a couple seconds and comes out of it. Halloran's like, you know, you almost like died and you almost like killed us. And he's like, I didn't even remember that. It's pretty interesting because that's common within exorcisms. When you hear the stories about it, like people generally just don't remember things. So it's hard for them to account, you know, like something like this. That's why Bowden was like spot on when early on he was like, nope, we're going to record this whole thing from beginning to end. On day 32 of the exorcism, April 16th, 1949, it's Holy Saturday, the day before Easter, and the Alexian brothers start like kind of really getting involved now into the exorcism. So one of the brothers brings in a statue of Saint Michael. So Saint Michael is like the patron saint of saviors. So he's like the guy that goes in and kicks all the evil's asses and all that kind of stuff. So many people in the Catholic faith, they will pray for faith and strength to Saint Michael. And it was said that like any time they would say like prayers to Saint Michael, that Roland would be like calm, and he actually would react positively towards the prayers of Saint Michael, and it seemed to kind of keep him at peace. So the priests now are making a connection. We feel like we're getting somewhere now. We're seeing a reaction that's positive using through Saint Michael. So Saint Michael comes up a lot now. The end of the exorcism, which is super interesting, I find, for this whole process that Roland was going through, like, you know, everything didn't work, but this one little thing, not one little thing, but saying like, let's just focus on the things that are kind of giving him and us a positive reaction. So day 34, April 18th, 1949, the exorcism continues. When the priests actually now, like in the beginning, like they were giving him like the relics and the holy water, having him wear like medals and stuff like that, that he couldn't keep it on him, or he couldn't touch it. You know, he was getting that physical reaction from it. Priests basically kind of got aggressive and were like, you know, no, you're going to hold on to this crucifix. You're going to wear these medals. You're going to relics pinned to you. He would scream. He would say how painful like they were and how much pain they were causing him. They were leaving markings on his body, but the priests were like, you know, we can't keep, like, we have to get through this. We have to let these things do what they're supposed to do. Yes, he's supposed to be getting a reaction, but we can't stop the process, because every time we stop and restart, it's just not working. So we have to go down through this journey. Father Bowden is like wiped. These priests are, poor guys, are like exhausted. So now he's like probably at his wit's end. So he basically gets like really aggressive with devil or the demon and wanting to know like, who are you? So Roland's going through like these like intense like fits and seizures. Bowden and the rest of the priests are like worn out, they're tired, they've lost weight, they're not eating. It said that Bowden actually started getting like open sore blisters on his skin. It got so intense that Bowdern basically put like every single relic that they have. They made him hold a cross. They made him wear like these medals. And they basically told like the demon, like, you need to announce yourself. We need to know who you are because we want to know. We're pissed off. We're tired of doing this. We're tired of fighting with you. We're like gonna fuck shit up if you don't tell us who you are and why you are doing this to Roland. And after several hours of doing this, it said that Roland started to like calm down and got to a place of calm, and then it kicked all back up again. And Bowdern was like adamant, like, no, you're not gonna do this stop and start. I want to know who you are. And it was said that Roland said in like a voice that was not his own that he only has to say one word, one more word, one little word, I mean one big word. He will never say it. I'm always in him. I may not have much power always, but I am in him. He will never say the word. Kind of fucking creepy. This is not something a 13-year-old is going to be making up in his head. You know what I mean? I think about a 13-year-old that, you know, are they thinking about things like that? Are they saying things like that? No, they're not. So they continually, like, really keep the intensity and the prayers and the holy water and you know, just having all the relics around him, even though it's, like, causing Roland so much pain. They just have to keep at it because they're not, like, feeling like they're getting somewhere, like they're getting, like, the demon to acknowledge that this is going on, that we're fighting for this kid. It said that he just kind of, like, stopped again and then started saying prayers to Saint Michael. He said the word Dominus. Then, after saying Dominus, he's, like, really, like, going whole kit and caboodle at, like, the most that these priests have seen. Awakes from this fit and is, like, totally calm. Like, they've never seen him. Of course, they kind of, like, you know, they're giving him a chance to, like, have a few minutes to, like, recoup from this. And they're asking him, like, does Roland remember anything? And Roland remembers, this is kind of creepy, it always gives me chills, that he was standing in front of, like, a cave, and this angel came down with a flaming sword, was fighting demons and the devil back into the cave. And that's when Saint Michael said Dominus, which means my lord. And Roland wakes up and he's laying in his bed. And it was nothing like that they could explain. But he depicted the whole Saint Michael thing story to the T of like what's in the Bible and how he's our protector. And Roland, being a Lutheran, had no idea about Saint Michael, which is super interesting. So let's talk about, like, after the exorcism. Roland kind of stayed in the Alexian Brothers Hospital for, like, a couple weeks until he fully recuperated physically and went back to his home in City, Maryland, and was said to, like, start resuming normal life. He went back to school. He went to high school. He always stayed in touch with Father Bowdern throughout the years until he went to college. He went to college and, get this, he became a fucking rocket scientist. Not just smart, like, he legit became a rocket scientist and started working for NASA. He is said to have had, like, patents under his name that were designs for, like, shields around, like, space shuttles. I mean, like, crazy shit. Like, it makes me think about, like, did all that stuff have, like, this open up this door to his mind that, like, thought on a different level? He led a normal life after that. He had kids, you know, he has grandkids now. He should be, like, in his 80s by now. His identity was always kept private. He did not want to, like, exploit the priests, his situation, and have, like, the media kind of all up in his shit, you know, his family shit, that he wanted really to live, like, a normal life. And he even said, like, how can I, like, talk about this stuff in the media or in public when some of it I don't even remember. Through all that trauma, it led to Roland having a decent life. Until this day, the Catholic Church still does not confess or deny that that the events actually even happened. There actually was like 48 eyewitnesses from like all kinds of like clergy during this whole situation with Roland Doe. It's kept under like secret lock and key in the Vatican, like the end report of everything. We're going by the account of the of Bowdern and Halloran being in the room, but there's an actual report that's sitting somewhere locked in like some secure basement in the Vatican that really kind of like talks about like probably more in detail about the events that were going on. And another like crazy thing about the story, like there's so many layers to Roland Doe's exorcism story that it's, you can go down like a rabbit hole for like ever. In like 1978, they were tearing down the psychiatric wing of the Alexian Brothers Hospital. Remember where Roland kind of like, the exorcism really kind of like took its place and like where things ended with him. And when they were knocking down the wing, there was like a room that was standing that was behind like a locked door. So they had to like go in there. When they went in there, there was like desks in the room, and they went through the desks, and in the desk was a copy of Halloran's journal that outlined all these events. So pretty freaky that was one of the only things that were standing when the wrecking ball went into the Alexian Brothers psychiatric wing when they were demolishing it. And if that wasn't found, because when they found it, they brought it to Georgetown. Let's go back to Georgetown. So they brought it to Georgetown University and gave it to the fathers there, the clergy there. That's how William Peter Blatty got the inspiration and this detailed chronological kind of document about what happened with Roland Doe. And if that never happened, we would never have had the Exorcist novel. We would never have the movie that it is today. The Exorcist has sold over 20 like million copies in print and have made about $444 million in box office sales, and consistently still remains like one of the most creepiest, scariest horror novels and movies ever made. There's also like a guy, he's like an investigative journalist. His name is Stephen LeChance. So Stephen wrote a book. I'll put it in the comments or the details of this video. But the book basically talks about a situation that happened with him. He reached out, was doing some investigative work about this whole Roland Doe exorcism thing, and made contact with these priests that took him to a hospital that was next to the Alexian Brothers Hospital. And in that hospital, they kind of were like walking him down like this really desolate hallway. There wasn't really much activity going on. They basically come to a door. He goes to open the door, LeChance, and they're like, no, you can't go in there. And he's like, why? They're like, put your ear to the door. So he puts his ear to the door and he hears like these like groans and like these growls and like stuff flying and crashing against the wall. And they're basically tell him that what the last day of the exorcism with Roland, that one of the priests in the room got possessed. Like it left Roland and went into like a priest that was kind of like young, didn't have his faith secured as much. And it's actually super interesting because that is covered in a documentary, which I'll also post down below, which is called Leap of Faith. William Friedkin, his accounts of like the Exorcist. So William Friedkin is the director of the movie. When you watch the documentary, that he actually talks about getting into like literally some heated disputes with Blatty when he was doing the Exorcist, because he did not want it to end where Father the demon and says, like, basically, come into me, come into me.
You son of a bitch! Come into me! God damn you!
You know, spoiler alert, but if you haven't seen it, you're living under a rock. Father basically commits suicide with the demon inside of him, and in subsequent sequels to The Exorcist, Exorcist 3 is about Father him being still possessed by this demon. Which is kind of like what the Alexson brothers were trying to tell the Chance, was like, this guy in here, his body, he's in somebody else's body, and we have to keep him contained and under secrecy. So super, you know, the book is super interesting. Go check it out. But yeah, this was like, thank you guys for taking this journey with me. But can you imagine being in Roland's shoes and all this is going on, his parents, even the priest, and, you know, some really, like, intense shit. It actually is scarier than the movie and the book that, you know, like, even when I read the journal or the diary from Halloran, it's, like, spine-tingling. It's, like, the things that nightmares are made of, like, and it kind of makes us have to question, like, is there forces beyond the norm that we are not ready to maybe deal with or even contemplate? But yet there's proof that exists that things have happened and are probably still happening, like, right now as we speak. So I know this one was, like, intense for you guys. I hope you kind of, like, took the journey with me down the road to through the whole exorcism. I mean, they give us, like detailed account Roland went through, and you know what, if this was the trauma and the experience that really happened for this guy, I don't blame him at all for not wanting to share his story. That's traumatizing enough then to have the media and the world pick and choose and criticize what is real and what was not real when it really happened to you, some fucked up shit. So I want to thank my partners in this video, Silence Apparel, for the dope gear, appropriate, Exorcist, nice stuff. Go out there and get Silence Apparel, and I will see you guys next time with another dope, creepy as fuck, or like totally interesting story on history, mystery, and beyond. And until then, stay curious.